Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guests Linda Starr Wolf and Nita Gage. They have co-authored a book called Soul Whispering, The Art of Awakening Shamanic Consciousness. Linda Starr Wolf is a founding director and president of Venus Rising Association for Transformation, Venus Rising University, and the Shamanic Ministers Global Network. She's the creator of the Shamanic Breathwork Process and author of 9 books, and I believe we've interviewed her on some of her books previously. And Nita Gage has a doctorate in Shamanic Psycho-Spiritual Psychology and a master's degree in clinical psychology, and she is the co-founder of the Neuroimaginal Institute and director of Healer Within Retreats around the world. Welcome, both of you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you, Susan. Delightful.
So, you both have a long history in reading about your, you know, your history in the book, and as well knowing you individually because you've been on the show before. Would you like to? I guess we'll start off with looking a little bit about shamanic psycho-spiritual psychology, and specifically the shamanic breathwork practice, because that's something that is a great transformative practice, and something that I think our listeners would be interested in learning about. Would you like to start there and give a little bit about your history and how you came to become involved in this work?
Great.
Either one.
Okay, I'll give it a start since we're going to talk about breathwork a little bit. This is Star Wolf. And first of all, I'd like to say that Nita and I have been, I say, best friends and partners in crime for a long time, going on 3 decades. But prior to that, both of us were on parallel paths, across the world from one another. And both, came out of the 60s era. Our first chapter in our book is From Baby Boomers to Shamans. And so we realized our baby booming was our kind of our earliest training in becoming shamans or shamanic. And that we were in preparation and didn't know it, like a lot of people, I guess you could say, from life. But collectively, together, we have at least 70 and probably more years of shamanic psycho-spiritual training and experiences to really be able to speak into this body of work. And each of us have developed our own kind of ways of doing shamanic work in the world, but it's also very similar. And some of it we've done together and some of it we've done, and more of a singular path, but it's always been woven back in over the years. We've always come back together and done things together. So this book was really a collection of our experiences, what we've learned together and separately, both before we met, after we met, and then since then, throughout the years, and what we've put together and the different practices that we've pulled together and created or co-created to bring to the world. So that's really where the shamanic psycho-spiritual comes from, because Susan, one thing you may not know is that about 15 years ago, I actually coined the phrase shamanic psycho-spiritual. Psycho-spiritual was a term, and shamanic was, but putting the two together, or the three, shamanic psycho-spiritual was a phrase that I coined when we birthed our university. And so that came from, for me, the breathwork experience, and Nita can speak into her own energies around that, but I will say that I have been involved with some form of breathwork really since my 20s, starting with transcendental meditation, with yoga, with different breathing practices, those kinds of things, which then led me to holotropic breathwork with Stan Grof, who most people who know anything about breathwork know Stanislav Grof, the founder of holotropic breathwork. And then led me to my main breathwork teacher, which was Jacqueline Small, with the Psyche Institute and integrative breath work. And then after that, I discovered a Native American grandmother named Grandmother Twyla Nitch, who is the grandmother of the Seneca Wolf Clan. And between the shamanic work that I learned from indigenous teachers, and between that and the breathwork practices I was doing, a little over 22 years ago, I birthed Venus Rising Association for Transformation and the shamanic breathwork journeys or practices. So the breathwork itself is a shamanic tool, and it is a way to really find the soul whisperer within ourselves, and also learn how to help other people to listen to their inner soul whisperer or wisdom keeper. And so I'm going to, I've said a lot here, so I'm going to pass the baton over to Nita to speak to us a little bit more about shamanic psychology or whatever else it is that she wants to say at the end of this.
Okay, thank you, Star Wolf, and for letting us talk about this. Well, I think what I would add, because as Star Wolf said, we have had very similar paths, and I came to the breath work many years ago as well through first Dan Groff in the 70s and briefly then, but really with Jacqueline Small and then with Star Wolf. What I've been doing as well is working with physicians and nurses and in psychiatric hospitals, and originally that was my work. I know it was for Star Wolf as well. And what I've found over the last couple of decades in doing shamanic journeys, shamanic breathwork with physicians and with other healthcare practitioners, is this longing in the medical and psychological community for a deeper connection to self or a connection to spirit, however you want to name it. For some people, you know, they can talk about it in terms of connection to their spirit. Other people, it's just they want connection to their essence. And modern medicine has really gotten to the place, finally, where they recognize that while they're very good at acute diseases and you really want them around for your surgery and really serious acute diseases, for long-term chronic illnesses, whether that's diabetes or depression and everything in between, they're really turning to indigenous people to learn how to get people in touch with their mind, body, spirit for healing. So that's the work I've been doing for a long time. Star Wolf's done a lot of that as well. It was my main focus for quite a while. That's really what I would add, is that I've been drawn into the healthcare world, if you like, and also repelled by it because it's been so compartmentalized, both in psychology and medicine, that I think what we're trying to bring with the book is that integration, and to show people that there's a path for that, your healers within, your shamans within, your wisdom keepers within. You got to slow down and listen to yourself. And it's just a brief, and that I think is the description of shamanic psycho-spiritual psychology, is really using altered states of consciousness to tune in and to heal from the inside out.
And in your book, you mention that many chronic illnesses have their roots in childhood trauma, and I would even add trauma in the womb. I was an RH baby expected to live. I was the first total body transfusion at the University of Maryland. And you talk about synchronicities. When I went to interview for medical school at the University of Maryland, the guy interviewing me was a pediatrician. He said, "I know you're not coming here because I see all of these other schools you got into, but I'm the pediatrician that saved your life." So that's pretty amazing.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible?
What a shamanic synchronicity. We got that, you know? Wow.
Exactly. But, you know, I went back with breath work and released a lot of intrauterine trauma. My mother was trying to kill me, obviously, with antibodies. And she was paid $50 a pint for her blood because they'd never seen such high levels of antibodies. So, you know, I'm a healer like you two are, and many of us, because we have to go through this initiation, we often, at the time of birth or after birth, in early childhood development, have significant traumas that we have to get through in order to become healers. So That's an interesting thing. And then there's the whole thing about past life regressions.
Right.
You know, many of the things now are past life. So we're trying to heal that as well. So energetically, you can't really understand chronic disease without understanding that we are multidimensional beings with even past life soul retrieval missions that we need to do. So if you want to talk a little bit about that work, it's just really critical today in medicine.
I'm just going to say one couple things about it, and then I'm going to turn over to you to start talk about soul retrieval and soul return and so forth. Yes, thank you for that. I absolutely agree, and a lot of the work that happens with shamanic breath work is regression to early childhood, to the womb, and to past lives, and I think that's really critical. So I'll turn it over to you to talk more about that, Star.
Yes, thank you, Nita, and thank you, Susan, for speaking into that. You know, a lot of my work, for a long time I was a therapist and working primarily with individuals, but I've always loved groups. And I'm thinking back when my first group was with, I was in my early 20s. I think I was all of 22 or 23 years old running my first depressed women's group. It's what they called it. The mental health. We want you to run a depressed women's group. Little did I know that I had any depression myself or anxiety. You know, I was too young in some ways to even realize it. But, I had like 8 women in various ages, I guess, from about mid-30s to mid-50s. We sat around a big, long board table in the boardroom, and we sat around the table, and basically they talked about their depression, and I listened to them and, you know, gave them sage advice at 22 or whatever, you know. But anyway, what I've soon discovered in working with people, you know, all the way from there to the present, is that when we started talking and just talking about, like, what was, you know, happening in their life right now. And that's really good because, you know, we want to know what's happening. But I right from the beginning, started going deeper. And it's interesting because I had been trained to, like, you know, focus on the present. And in the present, it's all there, you know, microcosm and macrocosm. And I knew that was true. But I could tell that there was more. And there was a part of me that really wanted to know the more. So as I dug in a little deeper and people shared, you know, I can remember that every single person in that circle had childhood trauma. And so that's where it really began for me, is realizing that, well, the stories I'm hearing here, of course. And then some years later, as the adult child of alcoholics and ACA and OCA and those kinds of things, and codependency became a popular thing because prior to that, nobody had a label for it or really discussed it or whatever. And we started that whole movement and worked with people, especially from alcoholic homes, and we had to add and other dysfunctional families. Then we could really focus on those things that were happening there under the, you know, where families were so distraught and caught up in addiction and codependency and all that sort of thing. And then coming even closer to, you know, to where we are now, and, you know, like, when I mean closer, I mean like 30 years, you know, instead of 40 or 45, then it was like, well, wait a minute. You know, if we're really honest, everybody has dysfunctional families, you know, because our species as a whole is not very adult. Look at today. I mean, all we have to do is look at, you know, at the politicians, and we know this, you know, it's what's going on, is that there's this underdeveloped part of ourselves. And so through the years of just looking at all that, it was like, okay, we have to have methods and ways to get people to be able to release those patterns, not just know about them, but to release them. And they're very deep. And then in my mid-30s is when I really discovered shamanism. I already was doing some breath work, but I discovered shamanism. And bringing those two energies together and saying, you know what we're going to do? We're going to use the breath to time travel, to shapeshift, to go into the past or into the future. So not only going into the past for, you know, the tragedies or traumas of this lifetime, also begin to bring people into the, as you said, their past lives. It was kind of like going from their childhood and then suddenly going into what happened in the womb and all kinds of perinatal issues started coming up and birthing and how people got birth, whether they were drug birth, a cesarean birth. Myself, I had a near-death experience at birth because my mother almost died at birth. She was too drugged. They over-medicated her on ether back in 1952, and she almost died, so I almost died. So, and then the next level that came up in breathwork was, well, wait a minute. There's something even beyond that. And it was past life experiences coming up for people. And more recently, and when I say recent, I'm talking about the last 20 years, more and more people have been talking about their future selves. Their future selves. And so now we're really in this place of understanding consciousness maybe a little bit more, that, you know, that we are on this, in the shamanic world, and in the shamanic world, the past and the present and the future are just one continuum in the present. And that we can actually go to our future selves as us future ancestors to get help for a past life experience. So, or for a present day experience. So, you know, it's exciting to me that we are able to drop into shamanic consciousness now and be drawn to wherever it is we need to go. We can be drawn to a present day experience that's happened. Say you had an automobile accident, or you've come back from a war, from the military, or we can go into our in utero, or we can go to past life, or we can go to future life. So I'll turn it back over to you, Susan, see what you have to say about that.
I also wanted to mention that a lot of us right now seem to be doing soul group as well as familial group karmic resolution. So I guess we volunteered for this, but whole aspects of karma are being cleared now through this work.
Yes, and it's so needed on the planet right now. Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Susan. It's not just, and family of origin work that's been going on for a number of years in the psychology world has taken on a different realm that's going much deeper, and including in utero and past lives, but also just from childhood, really looking at it from a more shamanic perspective rather than a more standard way. So that often will include extended soul groups integrated with family healing as well. Yeah.
Absolutely, Nita, because, you know, part of what comes up for people now when they do the deeper work and, you know, instead of saying, oh, my God, you know, this family I came into or this situation that has happened to me, it's just, you know, it's so horrible. And how could there be a God that would let you experience this? Or, you know, and many people get caught in a victim mentality. And I've had things in my own experiences with my own inner victim. And I want to say that, yes, people sometimes are victimized. And, yes, that victimization can cause deep and lasting pain and issues and problems, you know, that come up after the fact through post-traumatic stress in all kinds of ways. But one of the things I was just pointing out to a woman who came through my training, we did a month-long training last month. Amazing, courageous woman, and she came through the training, but the training is the healing, and the healing is the training, and as she came through, she really started to hit some of her regression, and it really kind of started to affect the group and her and that sort of thing, and I had to say to her, and I'm going to call her a completely different name, I'm just going to say Mary, so Mary, this trauma that, and it was one of the most horrific childhoods I've ever heard, and I've heard hundreds of thousands of childhoods. But what I said to her, because I could feel she could really hear it, she was ready to hear it, I said, all that trauma that happened to you all before the age of 10 years old. What a horrible, and I acknowledge it, what horrible trauma. I mean, it was really atrocious. And those of us who've worked in the field, we've heard a lot. But, I mean, and it was by family members and other people and stuff. It was really atrocious. And I said, and now, you know, you're 50. Okay, you're 50 years old. So it's been 40 years. And, you know, so many things keep coming up in your life. And it's kind of like you always, you know, finding yourself in a victim place again or at odds with people, this or that. And I said, now, you know, there's a part of me that says you either have to accept you're born under an unlucky star, you know, or that people just, you know, seek you out to just abuse you. or that there's some pattern that's been put in place for you, a karmic or a soul pattern or whatever. And on top of that, you know, there's a part of what's happening in your psyche that's reenacting it in your psyche. And I'm not saying excusing anybody's behavior who's treating you this way, but there's a way in which you're hooking into this. And I said, so there's a way in which you keep reenacting the trauma. And she, you know, she was kind of upset with me at first. And then, you know, later on, she came back to the group. I don't know, it was maybe a few days later or something. And she said, what you said to me has radically freed me and changed my life. For me to realize that I am actually at this point, I didn't as a child, but I actually am creating the situation in my life. She said, I feel liberated. And I said, and furthermore, it may be at a soul level, you agreed to come in and have these experiences so that you could grow and come through this and, you know, that you can assist others or maybe just your own, you know, soul's growth, you know. And again, I don't want anybody hearing this to think that we're saying that people never are victims or that, you know, what people are doing to you is okay or any of those kinds of things. They're still doing wrong if they're abusing you. But at some point, if you're still in abuse after, you know, 50 years of your life and the radical abuse of when you were 10, you know, 1 to 10 happened, the next 40 years, you know, or at least the next 20 years or 30 years, there's some part of that that if you could take responsibility from it, you have a shamanic shape-shifting experience and automatic soul return, and you can stop it.
Right.
You know, and hopefully a lot longer than 50. So that's a really important thing for us to realize.
Well, you know, there's a dance between the victim and the victimizer, and it goes lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, and they just switch roles, you know. In one lifetime, you're the victim, and the next, you're the victimizer, which is very interesting considering all this pedophilia stuff that's coming up now with the Illuminati worldwide. It's almost like there's just this dance of sexual abuse that keeps going and going and going. And then at some point, you just have to decide that you're not going to participate in that drama. You're not going to be the victim or the victimizer. And like Buddha said, you're going to take the middle path and not do either, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's spiritual growth. Mm-hmm. That's the next level.
Absolutely.
But there's plenty of abuse going on Earth right now, and probably also beyond Earth, if you believe, you know, the stuff about the Mars colonies and the secret space program. There's a massive amount of sexual slavery and all of this stuff is going to come to light. And, you know, just stuff that, I mean, you and I grew up, I was born in 54, so I grew up in a world where none of this existed. I mean, we didn't even know that sexual slavery existed until fairly recently.
It's true, and there's so much publicity about it right now, you know, and it's coming to light. And, I mean, the human trafficking, you know, I think people have always known that there's, you know, slavery and human trafficking, but I don't think people really realize just how big a business it is. I mean, people say, oh, well, that's just in, you know, Asia or Thailand or, you know, something.
Well,
that,
and also foster care in America.
That's
the foster care system in America is what's feeding the sexual slavery. I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot closer to home than we would like to think. In Atlanta, there was, I think, 42 people busted in a ring, and my esthetician, one of her friend's ex-husbands, was part of it. You know, I mean, it is very close to home. You know, it's right here in Atlanta. So I'm just shocked at the extent of this. So we are still in the victim-victimizer dance very, very strongly. But I think that that's going to come to an end. I think all of that will be exposed, and that's what has to happen. It has to be exposed, because I grew up in a world where that didn't exist, as I'm sure you did for a while, too. I mean, we didn't know about it.
Well, I think it probably existed.
We just didn't know about it.
It did exist, but not in our world.
So, right, and so it's being, as you say, it's being exposed, and all that darkness is coming to light, and it's very messy. you know, it's like ripping a scab off that's got all kinds of infection underneath, and it's hideous, and yet that's the healing process. And it's pretty much happening planet-wide. And I like the way you're putting it. It's that dance of the victim and the victimizer. And the kind of work that, you know, we often, Stores and I often say, is that it's really healing the planet one person at a time. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, every mm-hmm. person that can heal that victim place in themselves, or the victimizer place. I mean, we've also worked with perpetrators. Like, I know we both have. And it's, as you say, Susan, it's just the other side of the coin. And each person that heals it has a ripple effect for generations mm-hmm. all around their community. Yeah.
Well, you know,
it's worthwhile work.
Yes,
even in the dark.
It really is. You know, I mean, just in hearing, and we're talking about the perpetrator, and you know, you and I have both worked with perpetrators, you know, that are self-defense or court ordered or whatever, you know, in the mental health days and those sort of things. And you know, that was really good for me, because as I did that, many times I found myself, you know, talking to that person, and of course, finding out that they were perpetrated when they were younger themselves, that kind of thing. And as I use methods that actually help them get into their heart instead of being scared and defended, you know, against it with me, but more of, you know, gentle breathing, or, you know, connecting with their own heart about how they felt about the perpetration they'd done. You know, there was almost always an opening, and there was a deep sadness and a grief and, you know, a remorse. Sometimes there's not. You know, or it's not evident, but there was that was there. And of course, when that would happen, whether I was seeing somebody at court ordered at the mental health center when I worked there, or in treatment, and they had been under the influence of alcohol and drugs, and they're beginning to reveal and talk about it, or whether they actually went to see them in jail. You know, I often found my heart, you know, I went in there kind of like, this person's a perpetrator. I was young, you know, but then I would come out with this feeling in my heart of compassion for that person, of where they were. And I think that the next thing that happened for me, you know, Nita and I have both done a lot of helping to pave the way for people to know more about shadow in this world, and that is the mm-hmm. inner perpetrator. I have, you know, had some perpetration in my life from people outside of me, but nobody has perpetrated me more than me. But, you know, the things in my life that I've done at different times, you know, the thoughts that I've had, the put downs that I've had, you know, I recovered from alcoholism 36 years ago, you know, the drugs, the different things when I was younger, some of the relationships I put myself in, those kinds of things. Nobody's perpetrated me more than me. And so that was a really important piece to own as my inner perpetrator. And then also, you know, looking at the fact that I still drive a car. You know, I just recently committed to stop using plastic. You know, it takes mm-hmm. 5 minutes to create a straw and 100 years for it to be dissolved.
Right.
And
right.
so
right.
that's perpetrating the planet. You know, so it's mm-hmm. all in levels of what we're doing. And, you know, what, you know, before we just go, oh, there are perpetrators. Well, we're all, you know, innocent, and we're all perpetrators. And it's in different degrees, and certainly we need to, I think, look at the shadow within ourselves and how that the perpetration is even happening at any level.
And, you know, the thing about addiction, which is so interesting, addiction has at its core often a shame or a lack of self-love or some other thing that it's really pointing toward what needs to be healed. And that's why, you know, once you acknowledge the addiction and start the work to heal it, then you actually are putting back together the soul pieces that need to come back together in order to restore wholeness. So the addiction's kind of like a red flag that something is missing.
Yes. Or as we like to say, it's a misguided substitute for love. It's what you're saying.
Right.
It's just to fill that void.
And it's also the grit in the oyster shell or the clam shell.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's the gift, you know. It's not only you know, we know this, and we say often say that the shaman is the wounded healer. And, well, you know, the shaman is a wounded healer, but it's important to move towards the healing part. If we're only wounded, we're not healing, you know. So the wounded healer is the one who knows the wound intimately, and that pearl has been born from the wound because they did the inner work to do the outer healing that needed to happen. And, of course, once we do our inner work for the outer healing, then we become soul whisperers, way showers, and space holders for others to do the same thing.
Yeah, that's why I was spiritually guided in meditation to get Dow Corning silicone breast implants, one of which was going to leak 30 cc's on the left side, and I was going to get sick. And then because I'm a medical intuitive, I could figure out the disease, which is actually very complicated, chemical toxicity that medical science knows very little about. And then I was guided to get saline put back in because the saline disease is mold-based, not necessarily chemical. And then I got that disease so that I can figure out why people were getting sick from their saline implants. So, because a lot of times they don't have chest wall symptoms. All they have is sick building syndrome, fibromyalgia, and neurological disease, and stuff that looks like MS. And it's really their contaminated breast implants. So, you know, that's an example of something just physical causing a chronic illness that you need surgery, antifungals, and detoxification to get well from. And the majority of women with breast implants have no idea that this is even a risk that they're, you know, that they're...
Mm-hmm. I'd never heard that. I don't have breast implants, but I've never heard that. That's really... I'm going to remember that information.
So if any of your women have breast implants and are chronically ill with fibromyalgia, neurological disease, or autoimmune disease, that could have a major role.
Wow, good to know.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're welcome. So you were talking about shamanic breath work. Would you like to tell the listening audience a little bit about that and what it's been able to achieve for people?
Sure. I'll start out with myself. When I started doing breath work, it really validated everything in some ways that I already knew, because I've always been sensitive and intuitive and, you know, aware at some level. In my early years, I had, you know, had quite a bit of experience with psychedelics during the 60s and into the early 70s. And I came away from that with, you know, due to the experimentation and then also a near-death experience that I actually had on drugs, I came back with a whole, you know, wealth of experiences, but not much explanation for it. And so, you know, I started reading things, you know, Ram Dass, you know, Be Here Now, you know, Abraham Maslow's work, you know, many people that were talking about, you know, perception and consciousness, what was out there at that time, whatever I could find. And it wasn't until I started doing the breath work and realized that in some ways it mimicked the experience of being on psychedelics or on plant medicine or a near-death experience or being really sick and having a high fever or whatever. In other words, it took me into altered states of consciousness that just kind of walking around in my everyday ordinary life that, you know, that I didn't experience. And it even took me beyond meditating, you know. It was more akin to how, you know, you might have a vision if you, you know, are, let's just say, making love and you're in a static state in that way, you know, or maybe really dancing all night long or something and you go into a euphoric state or whatever. And accompanied with visions and body sensations and past life memories and being in the uterus, you know, and in my mom's womb and being born and all these kinds of experiences. Because I did lots and lots of breath work, and it just ran the whole gamut of, you know, variety of experiences. and spiritual experiences and, you know, guides and helpers and becoming an animal and not only having a power animal, but becoming one. So that whole world opened up to me even before I had really delved into working with shamanic teachers that much or indigenous people. That's what really drew my interest to that. And one thing, okay, I want to know more about their perspective on this. So I was learning it basically from, you know, from the scientific approach and from the psychological world, but I also wanted to know the natural world. And to be honest with you, I really didn't see too much of that merging at that time. But by being able to go in and having kind of one foot in that, you know, the shamanic world and the natural world, if you will, and the other foot in that psychological world, I could just see how it was a perfect fit and how they could come together for deeper healing. And, you know, one of the biggest pieces for the work, Nita and I both agree with this, and that is that the biggest thing about shamanic world is nature. And we nurture in nature. And if we can get back to the more shamanic world and go back into nature, go into the park, go to the river, go to the ocean, go to the mountains. You know, if you live in the city, you know, plant a garden on your roof. Do something. Getting back into the elements of water and earth and fire and air. And Nita says that some of the doctors she knows are writing out prescriptions and says, you know, for depression, start walking, you know, taking walks every day for 30 minutes, that sort of thing. Even the medical world is starting to go back to nature. And that really is about going back into shamanism. And shamanism includes using the breath, because the breath is what opens up our bodies. It activates our energy fields. It activates the cells in our body. It brings in a new vibrancy. It activates the Kundalini life force energy. Gets us juicy again, excited about life, and opens us up to the fact that we are so much more than our age or any kind of illness that we've had or any kind of issue that we've got. Not that we, you know, may not need to pay attention to those things, but we're more than that. And that will cause depression to lift, anxiety to go away. People get in touch with a greater power, you know, some people call God or great mystery. And there's just a rightness with the universe that happens through these processes. So out of all the years that I've been doing consciousness work, which has been a very long time, and for Nita too, the most powerful process that I have found to work with people has been the breath work. And then adding the shamanic feel to that and the shamanic wisdom to that, to me, of course, you know, I'm prejudiced with this, you know, in a good way, I think, but that the shamanic breath work is one of the most valuable tools of where I've seen people radically change their lives. And in one of my first books, Shamanic Breath Work, I have many stories in there of people, you know, talking about their lives and how they changed. But at this point, Nita and I both have, I can't even imagine at this many, how many people we've done breath work with. Because, you know, I've done it at conferences with 300 people. I've done it individually. We just had 45 people go through a month-long of training. So it's a very powerful method for transformation.
Would you like to give your contact information so that, you know, they can look up these workshops and information about the...
Sure.
Well, all the things you do, but shamanic mm-hmm. breath work and the soul whispering workshops.
Yeah. The website is shamanicbreathwork.org, and people can write me at starwolf@shamanicbreathwork.org. And between those two things, and of course I have Star Wolf on my Facebook page, and then Nita, what is your email?
They can write me at nita@shamanicbreathwork.org as well.
Yeah.
And I have some other ones, but that's a good one to get me at, and yeah. Yeah.
And you were going to say something, Nita.
I was just going to bounce off that. You're talking about the power of shamanic breath work, and I just wanted to add that in my experience, the number of people that have told me that they have done ayahuasca and they've done LSD, and they've done them in ceremony with, you know, serious intent. And I'm not, you know, just talking about, and they've had very powerful experiences. But I've heard over and over again, and I know Star Wolf's heard this as well, that the breathwork process is often more powerful because there is a walking between the worlds of in and out of the altered state. And also there's mm-hmm. a tremendous amount of holding and group work that goes on, or that it's at least as powerful. And I'm bringing that up because we were talking about addictions earlier, and we're also talking about there's a pretty strong recognition in the psychiatric world that childhood wounds, past life wounds, are all part of what lead to depression and anxiety. And there's a huge comeback now of psychiatrists experimenting again with LSD and doing microdosing, then finding amazing results to people healing depression and anxiety. And I just want to make a plug for, I want us to be very cautious to not see it as the next pill that is being prescribed, because really what people are hungry for and what's healing them is their connection to their essence and their spirit, which can be gotten in a number of ways, and it's not the drug. And I'm a big believer in doing plant medicine, if, you know, and getting into altered states of consciousness, and it can't be isolated into a dosage that gets prescribed. And I do have a certain fear that it's going that way. So that's my little paranoia for the day, just to say that the breathwork is enormously powerful. So
I want to talk a little bit about depression and anxiety. Depression, just in my patient population, is often due to the chemical biotoxins produced by yeast and mold. Aldehyde is produced by yeast, and when you wake up, you feel very, very kind of depressed, chemically toxic. You don't want to kill yourself, but you do just wish you would die. You know, that's kind of the difference between that and a more classical depression. And then with mold, it depletes GABA. So what you have is a very severe anxiety that you can treat with supplements like Gabatrol or Gabamax that put GABA back into the system. So sometimes, and this is just my patient population, depression and anxiety is due to toxins, which is very interesting. But in the majority of cases, it is definitely due to, you know, past traumas and lack of connection to your essence, to your soul energy, especially depression, I think. Anxiety, I think, is multifactorial. You know, there's all sorts of different things with anxiety.
Yeah, and I also think one of the things that's happened in our culture that is a little troubling is that those two diagnoses, depression and anxiety, have found their way into ordinary vernacular language. Mm-hmm. And so instead of just saying, I'm sad, I'm scared, a lot of people are immediately diagnosing themselves with depression and anxiety and, you know, just casually, just I'm depressed, I'm anxious.
Right.
And so I always probe and say, tell me what the feeling is. Those aren't feelings. Those are diagnoses. And if they're scared or sad or excited, because with that common use of those terms, people then think they're supposed to fix it rather than just feel it. Right?
Feel it, let it go.
You know, we said a long time ago in the recovery movement, you know, if you can't feel it, that you can't heal it. And, you know, I think it's really true that we pathologize human emotions. And what I really think is that those of us who are I'm allergic to 23 types of mold, and so I'm the person you want to walk in your house if you want to know if it's got mold, because I can tell you in 2 seconds because I'll
like a canary.
I'm the canary in the mine shaft, you know. And you know, I have been ashamed a good portion of my life. I was ashamed at having, you know, such sensitivities. You know, I'm intolerant to gluten. I'm intolerant to dairy, those sort of things. And, you know, and then my grandchildren, you know, several of them were having kind of autistic symptoms when they were born. And we took them off gluten and dairy. And, you know, within a few years, that completely all disappeared. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of sensitivity on the planet right now, not just mine. I end up working with a lot of, you know, another word we hear a lot is empath. You know, and people talk about empaths and how social empaths are. In fact, I'm getting ready to write the foreword for one of my students' books that she's getting published on the empath. But for myself, I wonder if shouldn't we all be empathic? Shouldn't we all be sensitive? You know, aren't we all naturally? I mean, look at a child. Look at a puppy. Look at a kitten. Look at a baby bird. Aren't we all sensitive? And isn't there kind of a jadedness to that has happened and a desensitization on this planet so that we think certain things are normal? And wouldn't it be more normal to be shamanic and sensitive and what we call supernatural or, you know, having, you know, super senses, you know, super sensory, you know, is that really not more the norm if we were taught that it was and if we were kept sensitive, you know, the way that some of the schools like the Waldorf School or the Montessori School, those have been geared towards, you know. So whereas I grew up, you know, in Western Kentucky and, you know, a coal mining town and, you know, good people, but it was kind of like, you know, you got to be kind of tough and you got to this and that. And I'm grateful for that. That was part of my soul lesson because I'm kind of a tough gal. I've been able to handle a lot of things in my life. And at the same time, I was so sensitive as a child. And everybody said, you're so, you know, you're overly sensitive. And still deep down, there's a part of me sometimes that says, there must be something wrong with me. I'm so sensitive, there must be something wrong with me. So I think that, you know,
the problem is we live on a planet that still has cannibals and at the same time has spiritual masters. I mean, look at the broad range of energy that energetic levels. Energy determines relationship. You're not going to get along with people who are cannibals. I mean, you are not going to feel comfortable in a tribe in one of the small islands where cannibals live. You're going to have anxiety, and it's going to be appropriate, you know. So, and someone who's a lower energy will be very uncomfortable in the presence of a spiritual master. Will become ill. You know that. I mean, you hear the stories in India. So, you know, we can't all get along. We can't all get along because of a vast difference in energetic levels. So, you know, that's why we're more comfortable with people of our own energy. And most of us three, were born with a higher energy, probably born into a multidimensional reality that we were aware of. I know I had out-of-body experiences when I was three. And I had spiritual hearing. I had visions. I had full-on visions when I was young. And I was just lucky to be born into a family that didn't tell me it was of the devil. You know, they were Methodists, so I was lucky I was born into a Methodist family, which wasn't, rather than a Southern Baptist family.
Well, now you're talking about me. I was born into a Southern Baptist family.
Me too, and I was told it was the work of the devil.
You were more traumatized than me then. You know, I mean, really, it comes down to that. If you're different, you're going to be traumatized if you're in a certain kind of family.
Very true. And, you know, that invalidation, you know, that it caused me to medicate a lot, you know,
Me too.
You know,
I always like being alone in the woods, you know, like you said, going back to nature. I would prefer to be out in the woods just being in nature than to be with my other classmates, you know.
Yes. Yeah, me too.
Me too.
Yeah. I think we all have that in common. That's interesting. I grew up on a Native American reservation because my father worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, so I was always out in the desert.
Uh-huh.
It was with the creatures, and it was just so open and spacious, and I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah, and
we are coming up on
my grandmother's chicken yard.
Well, we're coming up on the end of our hour.
Okay.
Would both of you like to give the contact information again and maybe some words of wisdom to our listening audience?
Nita, you want to go first?
Sure. It's Nita Gage and co-author of the book Soul Whispering, Awakening Shamanic Consciousness. And you can contact me at nita@shamanicbreathwork.org. And I guess my words of wisdom are, trust your own heart and seek the company of people who have the vibration that you have. And you will know that if you trust your own heart. Seek the healing and continue to trust yourself.
Mm. Thank you, Nita. And thank you, Susan. And thank you for the good work that you're both doing in the world and being soul friends and connecting, helping to connect the dots at this time. And you can email me at starwolf@shamanicbreathwork.org. You can find a list of events if you're interested in having a shamanic breathwork experience, or if you're interested in taking a shamanic mystery tour to Peru or various places that travel around the world and teach, or if you'd like to do our training. And we also have a university called Venus Rising University and a ministerial ordainment program. So we have many, many things that we're doing. And shamanicbreathwork.org. And the last piece I would want to say is that I really believe that every one of us has there's nobody born without a soul. And that soul is always whispering to us, and sometimes whispering loudly. But it's always talking to us and helping us to come back into alignment with our soul's purpose. And I believe that our soul's purpose is for all of us to actually awaken to that soul whisperer, and what I also refer to as the shaman within.
Well, thanks to both of you for joining us today. It's been a delightful conversation. I've been interviewing Linda Starr Wolf and Nita Gage on their latest book, Soul Whispering, The Art of Awakening Shamanic Consciousness. Next week, please join us for the Hillary Ramio Show Transcripts. This is a book of conversations on technology, time travel, ETs, 9/11, and consciousness. Should be very interesting. Thanks so much for joining us, and please join us next week for Temple of Health Radio Show.